it's just so insane, some of the narratives that we saw this year where people were like, okay, I'm going all into MSTI and MSTR in order to extract the income from the Bitcoin volatility. And it's like these people are just completely missing the point.
I'm just really curious to understand how you thought about covering this, because it was so contentious, still is contentious, but certainly I think summer, fall was kind of the peak of just, you know, hateful tweets being sent around.
Maybe it is a good thing that there has been this whole hubbub-a-loo over the last couple of weeks about quantum, because it is a serious issue.
I think the funniest thing that could happen is we decide to freeze Satoshi's coins and then they're moved right before that happens. And then we know Satoshi's out there doing something.
Bitcoin is money. If it is just looked at as a store of value asset, it's going to lose its censorship resistance. It needs velocity. It needs to be moving around and people need to take ownership of it.
Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, I have Rob Wallace of Bitcoin News. Rob is an awesome guy, and we go through all of 2025. There are probably a lot of news stories you heard and have forgotten about, so we do just a full recap of everything and talk about what he expects in 2026. You're going to enjoy this show. Hey everyone, like I said in the intro, I have Rob here. Rob, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Cheers. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. So this is going to come out after the first of the year, but we're going to do sort of a 2025 recap. So much news. But first, why don't you just tell people a little bit about who you are, Bitcoin News, how that came to be, and we'll jump right into sort of a month-by-month breakdown.
Absolutely. So yes, I'm Rob Wallace. I've been running Bitcoin News for 3 years now. I joined on board at the beginning of 2023 after a decade plus in video production, media, advertising world, and had been bitten by the Bitcoin bug hardcore in 2020 and realized I couldn't spend any time outside of the industry without devoting my full energy and attention into it on a daily basis. So hopped on Bitcoin News in 23 just as the video guy, and then by the end of the year had taken it over, bought out the guy who was formerly running it, and have been in charge for, 3 years in total now. And it's just been a lot of fun growing the brand and making sure that everybody is kept up to date about what is going on in the world of Bitcoin on a minute-by-minute basis.
Yes, you're a great resource because we do our bi-weekly Bitcoin banter show, so we're constantly looking for stories and find your tweets and things like that up there, and it's incredibly valuable. So let's go back to January. If we can rewind to now a year ago. So first of all, following the U.S. presidential election. And oh, and by the way, for listeners, I'm going through actually a document that Rob put together. I'd had some general topics highlighted and he went month by month. I think this is going to be a fun way to do it. So, fasten your seatbelt. So following the U.S. presidential election, Bitcoin surged to an all-time high of $108,000 on January 20th. Obviously, there was a lot of anticipation coming into the new year that Trump was going to be the first crypto Bitcoin president, whatever you want to call him. What was your, in terms of your reporting on these stories, your opinion of, what the significance of the Trump presidency is for Bitcoin? I'd love to hear your thoughts.
It's always funny to look back on sort of moments of euphoria after they happened, right? And so he got elected in the beginning of November, and we went from 60K up to 90K in a matter of, it felt like days, really, right? Like 2 weeks, essentially, we shot up $20,000. And so that really set up very high expectations for what was going to come in 2025. We've got Trump round two. He's a grizzled veteran now. He's back, coming back with revenge. He's been debanked. He knows the value of Bitcoin. We've been in his ear for the last months on the campaign trail. And now he's going to do everything that we want out of a Bitcoin president. He came into power on January 20th, and we hit an all-time high, $108,000 for that day. And it felt like that was just going to be the beginning, right? That was the appetizer. And over the next 12 months, as we head into Q4 2025, as we are right now, we would be at $250,000 Bitcoin riding on the back of this giant wave of just regulatory approval and institutional adoption. But things sort of panned out a different way. So yes, that was the initial feeling, I think, when everything started off January of this year. Yeah.
What was your take then when, I think it was a couple days later, he freed Ross. Some Bitcoiners were pissed it wasn't technically day one. I think it was within like 24 hours maybe of taking office or something. But That was a huge story. Like, I remember the Bitcoin conference, everyone wearing the Free Ross shirts. And what was that, you know, from your perspective?
To be completely honest with you, this was the first time that I voted for president since 2008. And it was for that reason. I thought that if we did get Trump into office, that is one promise that he could easily fulfill with a stroke of a pen. And if Ross didn't do what he did back a decade ago, I mean, who knows if Bitcoin would be where it is today, right? I think he really proved the use case for Bitcoin as censorship-resistant money. And I thought that it was, I could go to the polls to try to put my little bit of effort into helping to get him free if I could. So yes, I voted for Trump this year because of that one promise, and he fulfilled it, right? It was actually January 21st, the day after his inauguration, he did granted the full pardon to Ross. And so that was really big. And I mean, it was so funny. I mean, Bitcoiners were expecting him to like sign the pardon during the announcement of his inauguration, right? I mean, our patience sometimes is very, very, very short. But it was within a couple, 48 hours, I guess, of him becoming president fully that he did sign the pardon for Ross. So, I mean, that is the most, I mean, successful thing, I guess, he did in terms of
Bitcoin. Yeah, that's how I feel. I agree with you. At this point, the one reason I'm still glad, not that I would have voted for Kamala, but the reason I'm grateful I voted for Trump was because we did get the Ross pardon across the finish line. I remember seeing someone saying, he didn't even mention Bitcoin in his inaugural address. And I was like, oh, like, we have such a long ways to go, guys. Like, we are not the voting block and like the power that we think we are. That's my perspective anyway. I think the fact that he shows up to the Bitcoin conference in 2024 and speaks, I think it is a big deal. It's a positive trajectory. But I think we're a long ways from anyone talking about Bitcoin and, you know, State of the Union inaugural type addresses is my opinion. Is that your perspective as well? Or do you think maybe I'm underplaying it?
I think you're right. I think we are a while from really, I mean, the U.S. government coming out and say Bitcoin is part of our national policy here, right? We'll talk about some things that happened later in the year, further on in this conversation. But I think one thing that must be mentioned at this point is that the week before he became president, he launched a meme coin, right? And if you, looking back on it, again, looking back on euphoria, it's really hard to tell you're in euphoria, but that was sort of a top signal right there, right? I mean, I think it showed that he wasn't really a true diehard Bitcoiner. He didn't understand it through and through, and that there were monetary reasons for him to be involved in the crypto industry. And he made a mass extraction event with a meme coin, right?
Yeah.
And a really crazy thing to think about and to look at is priced in dollars. Of course, this was 108,000 and we hit an all-time high in October of 126,000. But if you price Bitcoin in one of the world's hardest fiat currencies, the Swiss franc, that it barely cracked 100,000 the whole year, right? It tapped it a couple times. Once was when Trump was inaugurated, and once was when we hit $126,000. But that difference between 108,000 Bitcoin and $126,000 Bitcoin is all because of weakening of the dollar, is because of debasement, is because of inflation, right? So this, you could say that this marks the top of this cycle, if it is the top of the cycle, Trump launching this meme coin and getting inaugurated. So pretty wild to think about it.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of framing it. Yeah, to me, he gave whole new meaning to the first crypto president when he launched the meme coin, right? I think that to me was like a strong indication we probably weren't going to get everything we were hoping for as Bitcoiners. But you know, that's just part of the game, I guess. When you're Trump or when you're any politician, really. Okay, so let's talk about February. Mm-hmm. So there was the Bybit compromise. Yeah. So it was a $1.5 billion exploit. Was this the Ethereum one?
Yes.
Is that
yes?
Okay. So do you recall any of the details of that?
Yeah. So it was. Bybit is one of the biggest exchanges, I think, over in Asia, and yeah, they were moving funds within their wallets internally, and they got compromised when they were just pushing approve on their hardware wallets and through a multi-sig, and they got extracted by North Korea. And then the funny thing is that North Korea, what do? They went and converted all that ETH into Bitcoin. So I think that's the real lesson of this, the story here, is that nobody wants ETH. Nobody wants any of these other things. Even the hackers of Lazarus Group, know that Bitcoin is king, and that's what they want to turn it all into.
Yeah, I think the other, I agree. I think the other takeaway that people need to have is that trusting third parties with your Bitcoin is a dangerous thing to do. And I'm certainly biased at the Bitcoin way because we're all about self-custody. But there's really, you're taking on a lot of counterparty risk assuming that, because at the end of the day, like there are human beings who are signing in order to move funds around, and you're trusting that someone else is going to do it better than you. And it's not always, you know, the case. I think, you know, when you've got your own personal interest in mind, I think that's a very compelling reason to avoid this sort of situation. How about, we saw, I think, three strategic Bitcoin reserves at the state level here in the U.S., Arizona, New Hampshire.
And the big one, Texas.
Texas. Do you think that's my impression is that not a lot of purchasing yet, like a couple million or something in Texas. But like, is that a strong signal to you that like, that's a trajectory we're moving toward? Do you think 2026, we're going to see more of that?
Well, I mean, it's funny how momentum based all this is, especially in politics. I mean, Trump came out on stage in 2024 during his campaign and Bitcoin was still going up, you know, from 40, 50, 60 up until he got elected, and then it shot up even more. And so once he was in there and there was momentum, then it was taken to the state level. And we saw Dennis Porter, of course, and the Satoshi Action Fund. They were going state by state, trying to talk to state legislators to create strategic Bitcoin reserves. And there was, I mean, if you look at, there was that site, bitcoinlaws.io, and they had color in every single state when a law was brought up to push Bitcoin forward. And I think there was something like 20 plus that had strategic Bitcoin reserves that were introduced, but at the end of the day, only three went through. And I mean, Arizona is just using like seized funds. New Hampshire is, again, a limited one. And Texas is the only state that has actually so far bought Bitcoin. They've allotted $10 million in total. They've purchased $5 million so far. They started off buying the Bitcoin ETF, but have plans to convert that into cold storage Bitcoin once they work it all out in with the paperwork on the back end.
My prediction is we see more of the state's FOMO into Bitcoin, into strategic reserves, if we see a big price pump. And now suddenly Texas looks really smart for having thought of this and been at the forefront. But until then, I just don't think it, like I talk to the average person in my life who's not a Bitcoiner, and it's just the last thing on their mind, right? Like they're not voting based on strategic reserves. They couldn't care less. If anything, probably many of them would assume it's a waste of money. You shouldn't be doing this with taxpayer funds or whatever, which I sympathize with that sentiment, even as a Bitcoiner. But I think it's not like a winning move for a politician still at this point, I don't think. But I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Price is the greatest marketing tool that we have, right? And so when price is going up, there's a lot of momentum, and it's very easy for certain politicians to come out and say, hey, let's jump on this train and we'll have greater prosperity due to it. But as we are right now, yeah, I think there's going to be some time before we really see that sort of wave of the momentum come back.
Okay, last one for February. You have MSTY, big fail.
So, I mean, this was coming off of course, Strategy really blew the roof off in December of 24, right? Shooting all the way up to $500+ per share. And then came all these financial products that were based around it. And so MSTY is an ETF that sells covered calls, which is essentially selling the volatility to provide income for people. But people, it's just so insane to some of the narratives that we saw this year where people like, okay, I'm going all into MSTY and MSTR in order to extract the income from the Bitcoin volatility. It's like these people are just completely missing the point. We have all these financial products that really sort of muddy the vision of what's really important here in terms of Bitcoin and self-sovereignty and the ability to take your wealth anywhere in the world at any time with a 12-word phrase in your head. And so, yeah, this was a big theme in the early on in the year, people trying to use these financial products based around Bitcoin, but are not Bitcoin, to become extremely wealthy. Well, a lot of these things blew up fantastically, and MSTY is certainly one of them.
Yeah, the Treasury Cobros have been pretty quiet lately for obvious reasons. Okay, so in March, we had Josh Mandel called for 84K Bitcoin on Pi Day. He nailed it. We had this price correction after the January peak, you know, in that $80,000 to $88,000 range. That was a wild moment. Like, even I'm not like a price prediction guy. I don't care. I'm into the self-sovereignty, but pretty crazy. Like, he hit the nail on the head. He completely missed, I think, later in the year. I'm not sure if that's in the document or not, but what was your reaction, and what was the reporting around Josh's prediction?
Yeah, I mean, he made that call, I believe, in the fall of 24. So that was like 6 months out or whatever. And I mean, to call Bitcoin at that level and nail it like that is pretty impressive. Who knows? I mean, he says he had some weird excuses. He's like a time traveler and there's all this esoteric weird stuff going on. And he's a funny dude, kind of a weird dude, but I mean, he's made a lot of money in the financial markets. There's no doubt about that. But yeah, that sort of made his legend, right? And then for the rest of the year, people listened to whatever he had to say and thought that his prediction for later in the year of $444,000 Bitcoin within the year 2025 was going to come true in November. But it did not. But anyway, yes, I mean, it's funny to see that the different personalities that pop up and gain prominence within the Bitcoin community. And this was definitely one of the stories of this year, was his nailing of 84K and the fail of 444.
Yeah, my prediction is a one-hit wonder, because I think that's about the best you can do when it comes to price predictions. Bitcoin Policy Hour says, Washington saw the first formal Congressional Bitcoin Fellowship, a program designed to educate lawmakers on Bitcoin's role in national security. Was that like the roundtable discussion that Saylor was at, or was that like a more general crypto thing, or is that what you're referring to here? I don't remember this one.
Yeah, so there's been a bunch of movements in Washington this year, right? The Bitcoin Policy Institute, BPI, they've had a bunch of meetings and gatherings, and I think this Bitcoin Policy Hour was one of their initiatives, but this was just one of many. And you're right, we did have that roundtable where Trump invited all of the crypto bros in, and Saylor was sitting very close to the president himself, and we thought that that was very auspicious for what was to come in 2025. At the end of the day, it seemed like a bunch of hot air, because March is also when they signed the SBR, the executive order for the Strategic Bitcoin Reserve. Of course, that did a number of things. I think most importantly, it set a differentiation between Bitcoin and the rest of crypto. It was made very clear that any of the Bitcoin that is held on the government's balance sheet is not to be sold, whereas the digital asset stockpile of all the other cryptos that they have seized very well can be sold at their discretion in order to fulfill their budgetary needs. And that they were going to try to find a way to increase the amount of Bitcoin that the government had in a budget-neutral way. You know those keywords, budget-neutral. And so then we started coming up with ideas of they're going to reprice the gold certificates that are valued at $42 per ounce of gold and revalue that to the current price of $4,400 per ounce of gold. And then we're going to use that money on the balance sheet to go and buy Bitcoin with. That was one idea. But another thing they promised was that they were going to audit the Bitcoin. They were going to tell us how much Bitcoin they actually had, and that is still yet to be found. They had 6 months to do so, and we haven't heard a peep. So yeah, that was that March was when they signed the Strategic Bitcoin Reserve, and it is wild to see the fact that like Bitcoin on a executive order and Trump giving the thumbs up, you know, with it all. But was it, again, he's a showman and he loves to make a press conference, but was there any real substance there? I think the jury is still out.
I agree. So April was a minor capitulation and quote the bottom. Price dip amid tariff uncertainty. We had hash rate drop. We dropped below 75,000. I think just a lot of uncertainty in the market. And I think this was maybe the time when you hear like the gold bugs, like, see, it's not a hedge. It's a risk on asset and that. And to me, that's a matter of time. Like when we're at such low global adoption, Bitcoin's still such a volatile asset by virtue of its relatively small market cap. We're going to continue to see that. But for many of us, I think, who are awake to this, it is the safe haven because it's completely external to the system. And hopefully there aren't 100, claims for every Bitcoin the way that there are with an ounce of gold. But what was your sort of sentiment in April, especially as you were writing the news for, you know, for so much volatility?
Yeah, I mean, that was really like Liberation Day, right? They were bringing in the tariffs. They were going to reorder the geopolitical structure. They were going to stop trade with China. They were putting tariffs on islands that only had penguins as inhabitants. You know, it was really, it was like pretty wild. They just took a shotgun to global trade and said, held it hostage. But there was a massive pain, you know, that week when the whole entire market realized that, wow, okay, maybe they are serious about this. But that pain only lasted like a week. They couldn't really do it. They said they're going to strike all these deals with these different countries and put hard tariffs on them if they do not comply. And within a week, yeah, they capitulated. And so the tariffs are still there. I mean, it still is the largest tax increase in the history of America within 1 year, right? They've collected $350 billion so far from these tariffs. But has it done what it needed to do? In terms of changing our relationship with China in particular, not yet. We've got this like year-long detente with them. So the jury's still out. But for a week there, Main Street was winning, right? There was and Wall Street took a back seat, but it couldn't last for too long. So Bitcoin dove down when that all happened. But then Trump put out a tweet that said, now is a good time to buy. And ever since then, it's gone up.
So quick aside, do you think tariff stimulus checks are coming in 2026?
Some form of stimulus is coming next year, right? They have to. If they do not run it hot and goose the economy, then they're in real threat of losing the midterms. And if they lose the midterms, Trump is going to be a lame duck. And he's a man who likes his legacy. So I don't think he's going to take too kindly to the idea of 2 years of just facing indictments and all that kind of thing. So yeah, they're gonna juice the economy and give out some stimulus in 2026. No doubt about that.
All righty. So in May, we returned to $100,000. We had renewed institutional interest. We had Treasury company mania. All the suits walking around Bitcoin Las Vegas. I remember that. I remember a lot of suits and a lot of talk of stablecoins. A lot less talk of Bitcoin than I would have liked. Were you at Vegas?
Yes, I was.
Okay. What was your takeaway from the conference?
It was a big show, right? I mean, Vegas is where you go to throw the biggest parties, the biggest conferences, and make the biggest splash. They had JD Vance there. I did not wake up early and stand online to go see JD Vance in person. No, thank you. But I was there. We had a media pass. We were able to talk to a lot of people. The real takeaway, though, it was the suit coiners had invaded, right? I mean, it was Treasury talk mania. The MNAVs at that time were, for like Metaplanet, was like 8x, 10x the amount, like their stock was worth 10x the amount of Bitcoin that they had in their treasury. So, I mean, it really was the talk of the town, and everybody thought that all they had to do was throw Bitcoin on their balance sheet and they would be the new stock market star. That was sort of short-lived, and that sort of marked the top, in my opinion, of the Treasury companies was that conference, because they were the headlines of it, and everybody walked away from Vegas thinking, hey, this is the easy way to make money off of Bitcoin now, so this is what we're going to do.
Yeah, I completely agree. So then we also had the European MiCA impact. So the full implementation of the markets and crypto assets regulation in Europe provided some level, at least, of legal certainty that triggered a wave of EU-based institutional buys. That is not something I was tracking very closely. Is your impression that that's continued, or that was sort of a moment in time?
So Europe is all about regulation, right? And to a fault, they're definitely one step behind us, the Wild West that is America. And so, yeah, they had this new crypto law that was passed, MiCA. Do I think that that's really going to push them far in terms of Bitcoin adoption? No, they're headed towards CBDCs. That's what they want. And there's still a lot of wealth left in that continent, and they want to make sure that it doesn't escape. And so by offering CBDCs to their citizens, they're going to make sure that they can track every single last penny that they spend and make sure it does not leave the continent without them knowing it.
I think that's exactly the direction Europe is headed. It's every week we're talking about a new crazy story, mainly the UK, to be fair, but you know, across Europe, the CBDCs feel very likely. My thesis on that, though, is that the European Union, what they've talked, Christine Lagarde said by 2029, that's when we're going to have, like, the digital euro is going to be fully rolled out. And I am curious if the European Union lives to 2029 at this point, because I think people are getting desperate, pissed off, you know, imprisoned for, you know, violations of free speech, that kind of thing. I kind of remember the story. So Visa announced it would begin settling certain cross-border transactions using Bitcoin L2s. What is that? Is that still in play? Is it something they're working on? Was that just like an early announcement?
Yeah, so I think Visa is finally feeling the heat of Bitcoin and stable coins and knowing that their monopoly on transactions is coming to an end, and they need to make some changes in order for them to survive. So yeah, I do think that Spark, David Marcus's layer two for Bitcoin, is working with Visa. And I think just the headline is there is that the heat is on for traditional finance and these old companies that have gotten fat off the hog by just sitting there and collecting fees, that day is coming to an end because the technology is coming to eat their lunch.
Do you think there's going to be a stretch here, though, where the big payment processors are heavily integrated into Bitcoin as we migrate to, you know, a Bitcoin standard and the world, you know, sort of plays catch up to the fact that Bitcoin's going to, you know, eventually eat everything?
Yeah, I think sending fiat over Lightning rails is actually sort of a very powerful use case for these traditional finance companies, right? It's nearly instantaneous. There's very low fees compared to what they're used to. And boom, right there, it shows up. And so you can take any fiat, put it into Bitcoin, send it across the Bitcoin network, and it can have it end up in whatever fiat you want at the other end. So yeah, we're going to see further integration of Bitcoin layer twos in particular into the traditional finance system. And it's just a matter of time.
Yeah. Alrighty. June would not be a 2025 recap if we didn't talk about Core versus Knots. Summer was sort of when it picked up steam. I mean, as someone reporting in Bitcoin, I'm just really curious to understand how you thought about covering this, because it was so contentious, still is contentious, but certainly I think summer, fall was kind of the peak of just, you know, hateful tweets being sent around. What's your take on the whole situation?
Yeah, I think it revealed a lot about the community in a lot of ways. In a good and a bad way. I think Bitcoin, of course, is dependent on Bitcoiners to be its own immune system, right? There is no CEO, there is no top-down hierarchy. So it relies on each and every one of us to stick their hand up and say, hey, something's wrong here if it doesn't smell right. And to a lot of Bitcoiners, this Core V30 upgrade, didn't smell right. They thought that there was something fundamentally wrong here. I think we all agree that Bitcoin is money and that should be the primary use case, and that having more arbitrary data on the blockchain is not the best. But at the end of the day, I'm sorry, Bitcoin is a database, right? And so you can try to filter out this arbitrary data as much as you want, but it's a cat and mouse game and you're never going to find a perfect solution to it. And at the end of the day, people didn't want to hear that. So it got personal and it got ideological. You know, the battle lines were drawn, and the Knots guys characterized themselves as traditionalists, conservatives, Bitcoin is money. And they categorized the Core guys as libtards and purple hair and trans and all these different things, right? So I think a lot of it had to do too with the fact that we were promised this crazy year, and we had just won so much when it came to these regulations and the president changing. But price wasn't keeping up with that narrative. And so then we start looking internally and Bitcoiners when price goes up, we all think that we're brilliant. When price goes down, it's us against the world. And when price goes flat, we start bickering with each other. And I think that sort of was part of it, but it really just metastasized into something completely different and ugly. And at the end of the day, I don't think was really a net benefit for Bitcoin in terms of how the conversation played out and where it ended up.
How did you approach that? Were you having like representatives from both sides on your live streams, op-eds? Like what was the sort of the take that you, or the approach you took?
Yeah, I think that was our tact was to let people who represented either side speak for themselves. Portland Hodel, he came on the live stream. We had, of course, Tony from the Bitcoin Way on the live stream, Canute, and I appeared on some spaces that were the death of Bitcoin when Core V30 launched. I was over on that one to try to represent on that side. So yeah, I mean, you could say that we rode the fence, but at the end of the day, it wasn't, I don't think it was smart for Bitcoin or Bitcoin media company to really sort of pick a side and go all in ideologically on either. Bitcoin, if it's meant to be the next world reserve asset, it needs to be able to survive these ideological disputes within the community. And at the end of the day, I think that's really just what it was.
Yeah, I think that's probably a smart approach. Okay, so we also had in June some sovereign wealth interest. We had 110 resistance, so it hit $109,549 on June 10th. Couldn't quite spring to that next level at that point in time. Do you think the sovereign wealth interest that we saw, like that uptick, is that something? So this sort of goes hand in hand with like the SBRs at the state level. Like, do you think, what sort of timeline do you think we're looking at for it to be like every week there's a new sovereign buying, every week there's a new state adopting an SBR? Like, do you think that's happening over the next 6, 12, 18 months? Or do you think this is just going to be a long uphill march?
I think Bitcoin evolves and fits and starts. Like, something will jump out and be really take over the narrative, and then it'll calm back down. And then, sorry, just to add, I got a 4-month-old baby in the background. So, so yes, I think that Bitcoin grows in fits and starts, right? Like, something will happen and the whole entire world will take notice, and then it will come back down. So, I mean, back in 2020, MSTR popped up. They were the first Bitcoin treasury company. Everybody took notice, but then, I mean, Tesla bought some, but then that was it. And then the next cycle, you had this proliferation of Bitcoin treasury companies. This cycle, we had the first sovereign wealth funds buy in. I mean, Abu Dhabi bought $500 million worth, right? I mean, that's not a huge percentage of the portfolio, of course, but it shows that they bought and they've increased the amount. And so it shows that over time that they do believe in it. And we're also seeing huge endowments like Harvard. Harvard Bitcoin ETF is their single largest position. And they hold 2-to-1 in terms of gold to Bitcoin to gold in their on their balance sheet. So yeah, it's these things take time. And so now that we have this proliferation of treasury companies this cycle, I think maybe it'll be in a couple of years from now that pretty much every company has Bitcoin on their balance sheet just because they have to. And then we'll see the proliferation of sovereign wealth funds like we did in with treasury companies this time around. So fits and starts. That's how it goes.
Okay. In July, we had, first of all, we had a new all-time high. So $118,000 finally broke free of that resistance. Corporate treasury companies added over 128,000 Bitcoin in a single month, the largest monthly purchase in history. So a lot of big moves in July. This was probably a good time for your business. A lot of people checking out Bitcoin news, trying to figure out what was going on, learn about Bitcoin. What do you remember from the summer spike?
Yeah, I mean, summer in terms of finance is usually a slower time in terms of news and big headlines coming out. But yeah, summer was still good. I think we were still looking forward to Q4, and we thought that the treasury companies were going to be a big part of that. I think it was towards the end of July into August is when we started seeing some weakness in these DATs, and it wasn't so obvious that you could just buy Bitcoin, put on your balance sheet, and be a rock star. So I think we started seeing the cracks around then in the summer that maybe this was different.
What do you think the play is then for the treasury companies moving forward? If you can't just buy Bitcoin and put it on your balance sheet and make a bunch of money, you know, selling your stock, like what do you think we see more strategy-esque offerings that sort of integrate TradFi and leverage Bitcoin's volatility? Or do you think a lot of them die out and it's just, you know, well, this wasn't quite what some people had hoped? What like, where do you anticipate this going?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them now are down 90% in terms of stock price and are trading at an MNAV of like 0.7 to 0.9. So, I mean, they're trading for less than the value of their Bitcoin. And once you're trading for less than the value of your Bitcoin, you become a target to be acquired by companies like Strategy. Strategy has not acquired any other of these DATs yet, but we did see the merger between Strive and Semler. Semler was the second company in America to like follow Strategy in this path. And it just didn't really work out. They were like a medical device company that bought a lot of Bitcoin, 5,000 Bitcoin, but it didn't make their stock go crazy. So Strive is acquiring them, right? So I do think that a lot of them are going to be acquired for less than the value of their Bitcoin. And so that's an accretive way for larger treasury companies to add more Bitcoin to the balance sheet. And when it really comes down to it, I don't know if there's much more need than for one real treasury company to be the headliner in a certain jurisdiction, right? I mean, you've got MSTR here, you've got Metaplanet in Japan, Smarter Web seems to be leading the way in the UK. So I think each jurisdiction might have its own with their own flavors that are specified for that specific market. But yeah, you need to be able to acquire a lot of Bitcoin, get to a certain mass where you can then offer other financial products, and it just, not all of them are going to be able to do that.
Yeah, I think to the extent it's viable long term, which is still a question mark in my mind, is is this a winner take all thing? And to me, it seems like it certainly could or should be, because there's no limit. If once you're established within a jurisdiction, you know, if you're the Strategy of the United States, he's so far ahead of anyone else trying to do the same thing that it just seems to me no one's going to catch him, and there's no reason. It's the reason you buy, you know, the BlackRock ETF of anything versus, you know, some sort of smaller asset manager. It's because, well, you know, BlackRock's going to be viable and they're going to check all the boxes. And, you know, it's just like that amount of power that these, you know, that these larger companies have. So it'll be interesting to see, though. So July was sort of a wild month. August, we had liquidity expansion. So global easing, central banks and several major economies began cutting interest rates, flooding the market with liquidity. And that moved people into hard assets like Bitcoin. We're still seeing a lot of that today, too. I mean, that's like a continuous journey, I think, that we're going to be on for some time. But what was your take on that?
Yeah, again, I think in the summer, everything still seemed to be on track. We might have been a little bit behind where we thought we'd be at that time, but still everything was lining up for an explosive Q4. Yeah, I think August still felt good. I don't think there was any really huge headlines going on in August. But then we get back to the fall, the bankers come back from holiday, and we actually had a positive September, which is rare. We usually don't see that. And so that was a bit of a head scratcher, because September is usually one of the toughest months for Bitcoin. So That was interesting. And then we actually, as we have here, start to hear a little bit of the quantum stuff. Jameson Lopp starts to bring up the quantum stuff, which has really come to a head in the last couple of weeks over on Bitcoin Twitter now. So yeah.
What was the genesis? I don't remember Lopp being like the guy who kind of kicked off that conversation. It's sort of been in the back, like on the back burner. It's like a thing that we need to be aware of, or, you know, speculation about how soon that could be an issue. Was his take that this is something we need to get moving on, or this could, you know, jeopardize Bitcoin's, you know, future? What was his perspective?
Yeah, I think LOP, what we've seen recently has been a lot of hand-waving that, like, we need to do something right this very second as of late. But in the summer, Presidio Bitcoin, which is the Bitcoin hub over in San Francisco, with a lot of big players over from Jack Dorsey's Block and the other Silicon Valley Bitcoiners, they meet up there, and they held a sort of a Bitcoin or a quantum symposium over the summer, and they laid out a bunch of different possible routes that we could go. And Jameson Lopp, he started talking about it in the fall. And the real thing that they're saying is that this is going to take a lot of time in order to safely migrate over to a post-quantum future for Bitcoin. So even though it could be anywhere from 5, 10, 20 years out before there is a quantum computer that could actually crack, take a public key and derive a private key from it, what we should start doing is thinking about it now. And so maybe it is a good thing that there has been this whole hubbubaloo over the last couple of weeks about quantum, because it is a serious issue in terms of, if this does come true, then Bitcoin is the way that it's set up now is not ready for it. And in order for people to move over to a new signature system, it's going to take time. And we have to make sure that there's also the question that needs to be answered as to lost keys and Satoshi. If he's no longer with us, there's over a million Bitcoin there that are in the legacy addresses that are vulnerable, extremely vulnerable to quantum, right? So as a community, we sort of need to decide, for the lost and Satoshi Bitcoin, do we want to freeze it and allow it never to be lost again or used again? Or do we want it to be just open and that vulnerable to a quantum attack, to robbers to go out and steal that Bitcoin and use it as they wish? And I mean, in terms of the libertarian nature of the Bitcoin network, it seems as if I think people are lean towards just let it be. You know, don't freeze anybody coins. UTXOs are sacred, and the second you try to change that, there's a real big problem with Bitcoin in general.
Yeah, I think the funniest thing that could happen is we decide to freeze Satoshi's coins, and then they're moved right before that happens, and then we know Satoshi's out there doing something. I've got a podcast coming out this week actually with Hunter Beast. So he's been working on Bit360 and talking about that. My best sense of it is quantum is a real threat at some point in time. Yes. If it comes to fruition that quantum is what, you know, the quantum folks want it to be, it is a real threat at some point in the future. The FUD, I think, is way overblown in the immediacy. At the same time, I think it's prudent for us to be defensive and to, you know, seek solutions here, because, you know, whether Lop's right about the timeline or not, or whether Bit360, you know, is the solution we need, and it's, you know, we could be ready to go with quantum resistance tomorrow. I think it's good to have people who are thinking very hard about this, who are, you know, way above my mental capacity to consider all of the implications. I tend to personally be something as an ossification maximalist. Not, you know, like, I understand there are software upgrades. There's probably some limited functionality that could be useful, but, you know, to what are the drawbacks? What are the unintended consequences? That's kind of where I tend to go. And so I think that just needs to be done very thoughtfully, and probably over a longer time horizon makes sense to roll things out, because making a big change all at once would, you know, could be very concerning. Let's see. Macro headwinds. Rising geopolitical tensions in the Middle East saw Bitcoin briefly act as a risk-off asset, decoupling from the S&P 500. Was that when we were bombing Iran or supporting Israel bombing Iran or something to that effect, or was it something else?
Yeah, that was back in June when we bombed Iran. Yeah, I mean, okay. But like, man, it's crazy how many things happened this year, right? I mean, we were like sort of on the verge of World War III there, it sort of seemed like, right? But we just bombed their nuclear facilities, and then tensions eased, I guess, but I really don't think that story's over, right?
What was the tension in the Middle East in September? Do you remember what that was? I mean, there's always tension in the Middle East, I guess, but was there something specific you recall?
I think that was when Tel Aviv was getting bombs again. So yeah, I mean, it's just been there's wars going on this planet, you know, and they haven't cooled down over the course of 2025, which is actually the interesting thing that leads us into next year, right? So it's
do you believe we're in a fourth turning?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And these are all just some of the contractions we're beginning to feel as we get closer to maybe a climax.
Yeah. I mean, we're right now, right? You go back 80 years, World War II, 80 years before that, Civil War, 80 years before that, Revolutionary War. Every four generations, you forget the lessons of the great upheaval from the past, and you're sort of doomed to repeat it. There needs to be a refreshing. It's also because the narratives of the past no longer make sense in that modern world, right? The narrative of the revolution didn't hold as much weight in 1860 than it did in the late 1700s. Same way today, that the story of World War II doesn't really make sense to kids who are 15, 20 years old anymore, even if we who are a little bit older have grandparents who lived it and can remember it. The World War II narrative is sort of dissipating in terms of its effect of maintaining a narrative that creates a cohesive culture. And so societies need a refresh, and it seems to be every 80 to 90 years that happens because, yeah, that's the course of one natural long life. And you forget what got us here in the first place.
I think that's well said. Okay, so October, we had the 126K breakthrough. Man, if gun to my head, if you asked me what month that happened in, I couldn't have told you it was October. So Bitcoin reaches topping over 126,000, and the total crypto market cap hit over $4 trillion for the first time. So, but that was fun for business and a lot of the reporting you got to do. What do you remember from October? Because I don't remember anything, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, 126, it felt good, but it also felt like that was just, the appetizer for what was going to come for the next 3 months, because historically, October, November, December, best months for Bitcoin. Also, we're at the end of the four-year cycle, supposedly. And so we're supposed to have that blow off top. So yeah, it felt like, wow, okay, we're ready to go. And it was just, that was October 6th that we hit the all-time high. And it was just 4 days later, October 10th, that we had the flash crash. And there was a lot of really fishy things that went along with that flash crash. I mean, somebody put on hundreds of millions of dollars worth of shorts minutes before Trump announced 100% tariffs on China. And that's supposedly what set it off. But then the whole, like, Bitcoin, it didn't flash crash, right? I mean, it did go down from 120 down to 102 and bounced up a little bit. But there were some altcoins that went to zero, right? Like, it was really a complete bloodbath over on that end of the crypto world. And there's a lot of questions whether some market makers blew up, whether Binance allowed it to happen to attack some of their enemies. But I mean, the crypto people are saying that the market just hasn't been the same since then, and that it seems as if something structurally broke on that end, and we've yet to really see who the dead body is. It's not really floated up to the top yet, but maybe we're still dealing with the ramifications of that day.
So I remember us talking on the show, and I'm going to get some of the details wrong, but something to the effect of Binance has a stable coin. And there was some sort of an algorithm, something that broke, and a bunch of shorts were liquidated basically by accident, and so had to cover their short positions, sell their Bitcoin. And that was, and like that sort of thing takes a while to unwind from. And maybe even today, 2 months later, we're still experiencing some of the, you know, the unwinding of that accident, or maybe it wasn't an accident. I don't know. Was that a story that you recall or reported on?
Yeah, I still, even though CZ puts his hands up and likes to put puns over on X, like, he's sort of a gangster, right? I mean, like, Binance is pretty much a mafia operation in my views, right? They wouldn't have been allowed to get as far. I mean, they were kicked out of China, but they still have a lot of ties to the Chinese government, and they want to maintain their position as the world's largest exchange. And when you've got that much money running through your business, you can throw your weight around and you can take out who you want to take out. So Yeah, I do think that there could have been some nefarious things going over there at Binance on this date.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so October didn't quite happen. We moved into Moonvember, and that didn't quite happen. So this was some of the biggest news, in my view, of 2025. And this is, I think, some of the signal that people need to be paying attention to. And forget the price action for a minute. Block rolled out Square, 4 million Square merchants were able to begin accepting Bitcoin as payment. If you go look at the map, I haven't looked at it in a couple of weeks, but it's pretty sparse. Like it's mostly, at least where I am, it's mostly Stake and Shake is, you know, those are the places accepting Bitcoin. But a few merchants, but it really opened the door to allow something frictionlessly that prior would be very difficult to do. What do you think is the significance of that story?
Yeah, I do think that this is the headline of 2025. Forget the strategic Bitcoin reserve, forget the all-time high. Bitcoin is money, and I believe that it is, if it is just looked at as a store of value asset, it's going to lose its censorship resistance, right? It needs velocity. It needs to be moving around, and people need to take ownership of it. This incentivizes people to actually use their Bitcoin. So yes, as you said, 4 million Square merchants are now have the ability to turn on Bitcoin payments. I mean, and we're talking about mom and pop shops, businesses that run America, barbershops, bakeries, cafes, things where that margin, that profit margin is very thin and very important. So if a credit card company is taking half of your 6% profit in 3% fees, then it makes all the sense in the world to accept this deal from Block where there's no fees on your Bitcoin payments that you receive throughout all of 2026. Right. So that's the way that they're hoping to activate a lot of these guys. And once 2027 comes, the fees are still going to be lower than credit card if you accept Bitcoin. But yeah, I mean, I think that they really rolled it out in an amazing way. They activated the community. You're getting $25 as a Bitcoiner if you're the first one to convince a business to accept Bitcoin and make the first Bitcoin payment to that business. I've personally got my local coffee guy who works in a van to start accepting Bitcoin with his Square terminal. And I've got my breakfast shop contemplating it, you know. They empowered the community and they made Bitcoiners feel like they could go out and push Bitcoin adoption in their community by just offering these businesses a good deal. And so Block has done really cool stuff this year, whether it's the Square merchants. I mean, BitKey is a great, especially for newbies, onboarding for hardware wallets. They do Cash App. You can buy Bitcoin, some very low fees there. And they've got the map for where you can spend Bitcoin on Cash App now. And then they've also got Proto, which is their mining rig. So every single facet of Bitcoin they are touching. And it seems as if that company is unified behind this message, behind Jack Dorsey and spreading the Bitcoin story, gospel, and adoption.
Yeah, I love it. So Strategy versus JP Morgan. I don't feel like I ever got to the bottom of what was really going on. I think Saylor kind of brushed it off a little bit. There was speculation that JP Morgan was shorting Strategy or selling it off. Or what was your, like, to the extent that you got to the bottom of it, what is your understanding of what took place?
So famously this year, the short seller, Jim Chanos, he put on the short on MSTR where he was shorting Saylor's company and he was buying Bitcoin and capturing the spread. And so it seems as if a lot of big banks and hedge funds copied him. And when some people who use JP Morgan as their brokerage reached out to try to either get access to their shares or move to another brokerage, JP Morgan was very slow in allowing them to get access to their shares. So this led to a lot of speculation that JP Morgan was using their clients' shares to short MSTR. And they also put out a report around this 10/10 date, quoting MSCI. And so MSCI is an index, and they were one of the first indexes to include Strategy, and now they're contemplating whether they want to include Bitcoin treasury companies at all anymore, seeing them as funds rather than operating companies. So why would JP Morgan do this? Well, it seems as if they are also putting out their own financial products around Bitcoin, starting to, right? So it could be something there. Jamie Dimon, of course, the CEO of JP Morgan, has always hated Bitcoin. He's one of those, I like blockchain, but I hate Bitcoin guys. But in terms of what they've had to capitulate this year on multiple factors, now they accept Bitcoin as collateral, right? They accept Bitcoin ETFs as collateral for loans for institutional clients. So they're having to bend the knee. And now that they're in the Bitcoin game, they could sort of look at Saylor as competition, as he is sort of pioneering this new world of Bitcoin treasury companies and becoming maybe a Bitcoin bank in the years off.
Yeah, I think they think pretty long term, I suspect, and I would imagine. To the extent that Jamie Dimon has wrapped his head more fully around Bitcoin, which I tend to assume those guys who are dunking on Bitcoin all the time at that level understand it much better than the average person thinks. And they're thinking strategically about how do I protect my business. Okay, so December, year end. First of all, I mean, I was happy to see this. We saw a huge push for Pardon Samurai. Keone Rodriguez just reported to federal prison, I think 4 days ago at the time of this recording. What's been your approach to sharing that story and your take on some of the implications? Because I think the implications could be really big for scaring developers away, setting a terrible precedent, in my view.
Yeah, I mean, from the very beginning when they started Samurai Wallet, they were very clear not to be a money transmitter, right? They never took control of the Bitcoin. And so they thought that they were following the letter of the law and that they would not come into any of these problems. Well, under the Biden DOJ, they were persecuted and the case stayed while Trump was in office. And now, yeah, as you said, they just reported to prison. They took the plea deal because it became very clear that the judge was not going to cooperate. And if they didn't take the plea deal, they were facing up to 25 years. So they took the plea deal for 5. It's a tough story. I mean, again, these guys were Bitcoiners from the very beginning, 2012, 2013, and they've done a lot for the space. Some people didn't really like the way that they marketed themselves, or of course, they were fighting constantly with other privacy applications like Wasabi Wallet. But at the end of the day, they're Bitcoiners. They're providing a service for our community, and it's our duty to stand up and help them in this time of need. And so, yeah, I mean, we've been talking about it a lot, writing articles, reposting Econo Alchemist. He's been really leading the charge over on X. And so retweeting him a lot. And of course, sharing the petition. The goal is to get 100,000 signatures. We're at 11,000 plus now. But we've got a lot more to do, right? We got Ross out, and now it's time to get Keone and Bill out.
Yeah. Do you have a reason? So I understand I wasn't around in the early days of the free Ross stuff. I've only been in Bitcoin coming up on 3.5-4 years. It seems like Ross had like this very organic sort of grassroots movement behind him. And my sense is it feels like this uphill battle with the Samurai guys. Is it less awareness? Was Ross just way more public, like this whole Silk Road thing? Because that was making national news, and Samurai, you know, it probably isn't. I assume it's not making national mainstream news the way the Silk Road did. Because I had heard of Silk Road, not as a Bitcoiner, you know, just hearing about his case on the news. Why is it that we've got like 10,000 signatures or whatever, less than that, maybe even on the petition, where Ross is now free, you know, from getting, you know, presidential awareness of the case?
I think that, Ross's mom was an unbelievable advocate for him. And he had been in jail for, I think, close to a decade, right? By the time that he was free.
I think 11 years maybe.
Yeah. So this is an ongoing effort, right? Like this was 11 years nonstop of his mom going to everyone who would listen. And one person or one group that really took up the Ross cause was the Libertarian Party. So they've been pushing for the freedom of Ross for years. And then when that was actually who Trump promised it to first on his campaign speech, is when he went to the Libertarian Party and he he negotiated, of course, with, I think, Angela is her name, as to what promises he would make to the Libertarian Party in order to speak there and try to get them on his side. And freeing Ross was top of the list. And so it made a very easy alliance between the Libertarian Party and Bitcoiners, and between that fervent base of Libertarians and the money of the Bitcoin crypto community during this campaign. I think it was easy to make that an issue that was a easy win for everybody involved to get Ross out. Because also, I mean, I also think that time sort of makes it easier too. I mean, when the Silk Road case was really hot and in the news a decade ago, it would have been a lot harder to get Ross out immediately as soon as he went in. But as time goes on, these things become easier.
Yeah, well, let's keep fighting for him. And then last, you have Minor Capitulation 2.0, hash rate drops. I think we talked about this on a show recently, maybe like 8%. I think we've seen an 8% drop in hash rate. The price just has not been working to the advantage of miners. I'm excited that I get a chance to maybe hit a solo block with my my Bitax. what's your take on this?
Yeah, I mean, this year we hit a zettahash, right? And so that's like an unbelievable amount of computational power that is devoted towards the Bitcoin network. And so it's been three difficulty adjustments in a row of downward adjustments. And so I think it's all natural part of the system working as it should. Price has really diverged from hash rate, especially since, I'd say, 2022 or so. It's gone straight up after the China mining ban first time around in the summer of 21. And price has chugged up, but not followed hash rate in the way that Max Keiser usually says it does. But what do we see in these last couple of weeks? There were some posts on X about Xinjiang and Xi Jinping and the CCP cracking down on miners over in Western China. So is that the reason why that hash rate is down a little bit? Perhaps. But again, I think Bitcoin is more than secure at a zettahash at the moment. And it'll be interesting to see in 2026 if we do get sort of a cooling off and it stays flat for the next couple of months, or if it just continues to go upwards after this adjustment down.
Okay, so I think that pretty well covers a recap of 2025. So let's just talk very briefly about 2026. Any of these stories you think continue to evolve and play out in 2026 that you think are important, and any other predictions or thoughts about maybe how people should be, you know, anticipating what the new year might bring for Bitcoin?
Yeah, I mean, the greatest advice ever is always just to stay humble, stack sats, keep your Bitcoin in cold storage, and you got nothing to worry about, right? Work on your craft and provide for your family, and you'll live a simple, easy life, and you don't have to worry about all these crazy things happening in the world outside of you. But I do think that the cycle will maintain and will actually break the four-year cycle and will go higher in 2026. I think that there's been a lot of work recently by analysts, specifically Sminston With. He's put out a lot of great work comparing the Bitcoin cycles to the business cycle, PMIs, and the ISM indexes, and showing that we've been essentially in a manufacturing recession since 2022, and that with all this data center build out and infrastructure reshoring of manufacturing back in America, we're going to see a boom in that regard, and that should allow Bitcoin to take off. So we'll see if that theory maintains, but it doesn't. I think the pain trade is up at this point. I think a lot of OGs and four-year cycle maximalists have sold, and maybe this quantum FUD is part of that, hoping to see Bitcoin go down so they can scoop it up cheaper. But if we can bottom here in the 80s, I think the beginning of 26 might be slow, but the second half, especially as we get towards the elections, they're going to be goosing the economy. They're going to be throwing oil on that fire, and Bitcoin is just going to soak up all that extra liquidity.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. So, hey, Rob, I'm giving you an opportunity, though, for a Josh Mandel moment. Do you have like a day and a price number you want to throw out, see if you can be a one-hit wonder too?
Let's go with the opposite of the 1929 crash. So October 29th of 2026, we are going to see Bitcoin at 246.
Okay. Okay, bold move. I would have passed, man, but you're braver than I am throwing out a number. All righty. Okay, so last question for you, when I ask at the end of every show, what is an unpopular opinion that you hold? You get bonus points if you offend some Bitcoiners with it.
Responsibility is hard. And while I do believe that you should usher everyone towards self-custody and owning their seed phrase, at the end of the day, forcing people to take the utmost responsibility for their money is an uphill battle. So we've got to massage the way that we convey this to the public. And so I do think self-custody is the most important thing about Bitcoin, but the way that we teach it right now is there's a disconnect. And so we've got to figure out a way to communicate it as best so that as many people as possible do self-custody, but also you can't expect everyone to do it because the amount of responsibility in this world, I've come to realize as I've gotten older, is just not as high as I once thought it was.
Yeah, I think there's a reason. Like, we're huge proponents of self-custody. It's our bread and butter is training people. But I think there's a reason why a lot of people hold Bitcoin for friends or family members, because it's like it's that one person who's curious enough, willing to learn, willing to take that personal responsibility. And it is big. My hope is that maybe we can educate around not just Bitcoin, but why you need to be your own bank. Because when you look at some of the, like we were just talking about this morning on our show, new biometric requirements for banks. And I think it was maybe Vietnam, somewhere in Southeast Asia, biometric requirements for buying like a SIM card in South Korea now. I mean, just like crazy draconian things, all intended obviously to protect people and to, you know, prevent fraud and all that good stuff. But I think that there are way more people who are perfectly capable of taking on that responsibility who just aren't even awake to why they would need to. And so if we can get people across that finish line, I think it becomes much easier to compel them toward, you can do this other thing too. It's not that hard. You just need to be diligent, thoughtful, and, you know, have the right person helping you along the way. So, I think that's a reasonable hot take, but I think you'll get some, yeah. Did you say anything about Bitcoin? Someone's going to be pissed off about it. So, I have no concerns. All righty, man, this has been a great conversation. I think you did a wonderful job recapping the year. It's been a fun ride. Why don't you tell people where they can follow you, find out more about Bitcoin News, anywhere else you want to send them?
Yeah, absolutely. We are on X at BitcoinNews.com, and BitcoinNews.com is the website. Sign up for the newsletter. We send it out every Monday morning, Bitcoin News Weekly. Great roundup of all the biggest headlines in Bitcoin that have happened over the last couple of days. So you don't need to spend your whole entire life scrolling the internet like we do, but it's our pleasure. We love to provide that service to the people, and check it out, because we also do a live stream on Monday morning after the newsletter comes out. So you can get it live broken down for you if you'd rather listen than read. So check it out.
Love it, man. Rob, thanks so much for the time. It's been a blast, and excited to see what 2026 brings for us as Bitcoiners and for you and the Bitcoin News team. So take care, man. Have a great one.
Thanks for having me. Happy holidays.
And that's a wrap. Again, hope you enjoyed my conversation with Rob. Go check out Bitcoin News. Go follow Rob. A lot of signal, a lot of interesting content they put out. And of course, if you need help taking your Bitcoin into proper 100% self-custody, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can schedule a free 30-minute welcome call with a member of our team to learn more about what it is that we do. We also have online privacy options. We can help you set up a privacy phone, set up a BitAx or a solo mining rig, and we can help you with a Plan B residency option, also important in this crazy world. And of course, if you're enjoying the podcast, do me a huge favor. Like, subscribe, comment, share it with someone who you think might be interested. Anything to feed the algorithm would be most appreciated. And until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.